Okay. Hello everyone. I'm Dimitrios, final year PhD student in the Department of Physics here in the Cavendish. I work in the Optoelectronics group and also at the Royce Institute Cluster 2. I'm going to talk to you today about a study that we did on the effects of process-induced contamination on organic electronic devices. So essentially, we managed to identify a set of contaminants that originate from the processing. After we identified them, we then studied the effect of each individual contaminant on organic electronic device fabrication and characterization. And then we went back, we optimized the process flows, we eliminated all the contaminants, and that optimized process flow became the basis on which we structured the equipment of the cluster tool, how we actually chose the specifications for the equipment on the cluster tool. And on the first slide, on the left-hand side, you can see the major contamination pathways through which contaminants can diffuse into the organic electronic films that we fabricate here in the cluster tool. So we have three main pathways through which contaminants can diffuse. The first one, as you can see, is the fabrication glove box. So the glove box is important. Why? Because if there are any volatile solvent vapors in the glove box, for example, precursors used for self-assembling monolayers or volatile solvents, or for example, oil mist that can find itself in the glove box from the vacuum pump, all these vapors, when we spin coat a polymer film, or a general organic electronic film, these vapors can actually find themselves into the film when the film is spin coated and also when we anneal the film in the glove box. And even though we did not originally plan to have these vapors inside, we can still detect them after the film is fabricated. That's the first pathway. The second contamination pathway is through disposable plastic pipettes and syringes that we normally use in order to make the organic electronic solutions. So one of the major advantages of these organic materials is that they are solution processed. And this means that we can actually dissolve them in a certain organic solvent and then spin coat them onto a substrate. And that's how we usually make these electronic devices. Now, the disadvantage of solution processing is that very frequently people use plastic syringes and plastic pipettes in order to make these solutions of these organic materials. And quite often, the solvents used to dissolve the materials can also dissolve a little bit of the plastic syringes and pipettes that we use to prepare the solutions. So, as you can possibly imagine, we can find traces of these plasticizers that originate from plastic pipettes and syringes inside the organic films. And these plasticizers can affect the performance of the devices eventually. So that is the second contamination pathway. And the third one is the disposable needles that are used in the syringes that we use to prepare these solutions. So the needles, even though one would think that they are purely metallic, they actually have a rubber coating. And why is that? Because normally these needles are used to inject humans with drugs in medicine. So they have this rubber coating in order to avoid damaging the skin of the patient. But that rubber coating, as you can imagine, gets also dissolved by these same organic solvents that we use for our processing and finds itself into the solution of the material that we are making. And obviously it finds itself into the polymer film and affects the device performance. That's the third contamination pathway. And now I'm going to talk to you about, first of all, the material that we use, the organic material that we use for this study, and secondly, what are the different methods that we use to detect contaminants in organic electronics. The material is shown on the bottom of the slide. It's called IDTBT. It's an amorphous polymer that we commonly use in the field of organic electronics. It's a high mobility material. And now concerning the methods, you can see the methods on the right-hand side. These are the five different methods that we use to detect contaminants in organic electronic materials. They are all based on nuclear magnetic resonance, and each method is used to detect a different type of a contaminant. For example, on the top row of the right-hand image, you can see that we have the bubbled gas test and the substrate washing test. Now, these two tests essentially mean that, for example, the bubbled gas test means that we have a vial of deuterated solvent in the glove box, we bubble the glove box gas inside it, and then we send it for analysis. And the substrate washing test means that we leave a substrate in the glove box for a couple of minutes, and then we wash it with deuterated solvent and send that solvent for analysis. Now, why do we have these different two different tests? It's because they actually act complementary, in a complementary fashion, so to speak. So the bubbled gas test samples the glove box atmosphere and tends to detect vapors that are more volatile, vapors that are more likely to be found in the atmosphere. Whereas the substrate washing test tends to detect non-volatile species, species that tend to get deposited on surfaces, to condense onto surfaces. So with these two first tests, we are able to detect the quality of the glove box atmosphere. Now, on the top right-hand side, you can see the redissolved film test, which is a test that we use to detect contamination in organic films, films that we have spin-coated and annealed. And on the bottom left-hand side, on the of the right-hand side image, you can see the solution analysis test. So essentially, we take 3 microliters of an organic solution, we mix it with 1 mL of deuterated solvent, and we send that for analysis. And that's used to detect contaminants in solutions that we've prepared. And the final test is the disposables wash test, the test that we use to detect plasticizers leaching from syringes and pipettes, as I mentioned previously. And how do we do this test? Essentially, we just wash pipettes and syringes or even needles with deuterated solvent, and we send that for analysis. So these are the five different NMR methods that we use to detect the contaminants that I talked about before, the ones that originate from the three contamination pathways. And let's see what we see when we get back the results from these tests. On the left-hand side, you see the NMR tests, the NMR results originating from a bubbled gas and from a substrate washing NMR test. And as I said before, these two tests are complementary. The bubbled gas test detects volatile, and the substrate washing test detects non-volatile contaminants. So as we can see on the left-hand side, the NMR technique is not going to give us complete chemical structures. It's going to give us functional groups. It's going to tell us which functional groups were detected in the glove box atmosphere. And we can see from the left-hand side that in the glove box atmosphere already, we have substances that shouldn't exist there. So the bubbled nitrogen gas test shows us that there is this methyl siloxane group, this SiCH3 group, that is a very volatile group, predominantly present in the glove box atmosphere. At the time, we considered this group to originate from self-assembled monolayers that we were storing in the glove box. But we also see other groups in the glove box atmosphere. We see this OCH3 group, which originates from a solvent, and common aliphatic groups, CH2, CH3 groups as well, that are present in the glove box atmosphere. Now, the substrate washing test, the test that we did by leaving a substrate in the glove box and washing it, shows us that 3 out of the 4 functional groups, 3 out of the 4 contaminants, if you will, that we detected in the glove box are non-volatile. So if you see the substrate washing intensity peak, it's larger than the bubbled nitrogen gas, which means that these contaminants tend to condense onto surfaces. They are non-volatile, whereas the methyl siloxane group is volatile. We tend to find it in the atmosphere. And now, after we've identified these contaminants and we've seen which ones of them are volatile and which ones are non-volatile, if we look at the image in the middle, we can see the effects of these contaminants in the annealed films. So we have a polymer film in the glove box that we redissolved. We annealed it in the glove box, we redissolved it, and we sent it for analysis. And the as-cast film, as we can see, is less contaminated than the annealed film. So the main conclusion from the middle image is that if we anneal a film in a contaminated environment, the film gets more contaminated with time. So it's crucial to keep the glove box clean when we anneal films inside it. And the final conclusion from this first small study is shown on the right-hand image. And this image actually shows the analysis of the deuterated solvent as it remained in the glove box over time. And as you can see, a solvent bottle that remains in a contaminated glove box gets progressively more and more contaminated with time, even though the solvent bottle has a cap and a septum and it's supposed to be protected. We can still detect these contaminants in the solvent bottle over time. And now I will elaborate a bit on the data that I have just presented. I will show you what is, we talked a bit about what it means to anneal a film in a contaminated glove box and that the film becomes progressively more and more contaminated with the annealing time. But what happens when the glove box is contaminated with solvent vapor? Do we find this solvent vapor in the film or not? We attempt to answer this question with this following slide. On the left-hand side, you see a typical solvent that we use for the fabrication of organic films, which is dichlorobenzene. This is a non-volatile solvent, and its boiling point is really high. It's 180 degrees Celsius. And as you can see on the left-hand side, if there is a solvent vapor in the glove box, we can detect it with a substrate washing test, but not with a bubbled nitrogen gas test, as we expected. Now, what happens when we anneal films in a glove box that is saturated with this solvent vapor, with DCB vapor? Let's look at the right-hand slide for this answer. We can see that in the pink curve, we can see that an as-cast film, so a film that's not annealed, if it remains in a glove box that's saturated with solvent vapor, we can still detect the dichlorobenzene peaks in that solvent peak because it's not annealed. Now, what happens when we anneal it? What happens when we anneal the film in a clean glove box? For example, if we purge the glove box with nitrogen and anneal the film in a clean glove box, what happens? Well, we can compare the green curve which is an as-cast film in a purged glove box, so in a clean glove box, with the purple curve, which is the annealed film in a purged glove box. So if the glove box is clean, which means purged, the amount of dichlorobenzene doesn't change a lot between the as-cast and the annealed films, which is to say that the cleanliness of the glove box atmosphere affects the solvent content of the film more than the annealing conditions. So it is much more crucial to keep the glove box clean than to anneal the film if we want to get rid of the solvent vapor. Because as we can see, if we compare the two as-cast NMR signals, the as-cast NMR signal in the solvent-saturated glove box and the as-cast NMR signal of the purged glove box, both films were not annealed, but the film in the clean glove box contains a lot less solvent than the film in the contaminated glove box. Now, we talked about the importance of the solvent vapor and how we can get rid of it from the glove box. But as most people know, glove boxes come equipped with solvent filters in order to filter out solvent vapors. And you may ask yourselves, okay, what about the solvent filter? Isn't that able to clean the solvent vapor to filter out the solvent vapor from the glove box? Well, yes, to a degree. And NMR can help us understand to which degree. Now, if we look at the image on the left-hand side, it shows a typical solvent filter used in nitrogen glove boxes. And that is an activated carbon solvent filter. The problem is that there is no indicator to show when this solvent filter is saturated. We have no way of telling if the carbon material is saturated with solvent vapor or if it's pristine and can filter out the solvent efficiently. That's the first problem. And the second problem is that the sensors that exist for these glove boxes, there are some sensors that filter, that sense volatile compounds in the glove box. These sensors are not selective to each individual solvent. They are general sensors that some solvents always trigger them, some other solvents never trigger them, and hence it's really hard to find a sensor that's selective to the solvent that your scientific group is particularly using. Now, how can we use NMR to detect the saturation of the solvent filter, and what does this mean for device fabrication? To answer this question, we did the bubbled nitrogen NMR test, which is, as we said, able to detect volatile contaminants. We did that before and after we changed the solvent filter, before and after we replaced this solvent filter material of the solvent trap. And we also made devices, which is to say organic transistors, which are shown on the right-hand side, before and after we changed this this material, the solvent filter material, to say. Now, if we look at the NMR spectra, we can see that the situation in the glove box before we replaced the solvent filter suggests that the glove box was very heavily contaminated. There is a whole forest of peaks of unidentified contaminants. But after we replaced the solvent filter, as you can see from the blue curve, the blue spectrum, all these contamination peaks vanished. So that shows us that replacing the solvent filter is able to remove the contaminants from the glove box, as long as the replacement happens in a every month or every 2 months, depending on the frequency in which the glove box is used. And if we'll now look at the devices that we fabricated before and after the solvent filter was replaced, we can actually see a huge difference. So the red curves show us the devices that were made before the solvent filter was replaced. And as you can see, the pristine device, so a device that is made without any sort of small molecules or anything added to it for stabilization, so just a pristine polymer film or a pristine small molecule film. In our case, as we said, it's IDTBT material. The pristine device behaves quite well. And this is probably because the contaminants in the glove box have some sort of performance enhancing effect. Now, when we make the same transistor, the pristine transistor, in a clean glove box, the behavior, the performance is much worse, as you can see. And that is, in our experience, what it should be. IDTBT pristine transistors usually do not perform very well. And to enhance their performance, of course, the contaminants can enhance the performance, as we see. To enhance their performance, we usually use some performance enhancing additives, such as, for example, BDOPV or F2TCNQ. This is a typical strategy used in the literature. The point that I'm trying to make is that in order to understand whether or not the additive improves the performance of the transistor, the glove box has to be clean. Otherwise, we may mistakenly believe that the effect of the contaminant, the beneficial effect of the contaminant, is due to the additive. So, in order to demonstrate that, we compare two additives, an additive called BDOPV and an additive called F2TCNQ. The BDOPV additive does not offer any performance enhancement to these transistors. And we can see that because when we measure a device in a contaminated glove box with BDOPV, the device performs well, but if we then replace the solvent trap, the device with BDOPV does not perform well the performance enhancement was not due to BDOPV, it was because of the contaminants. But this does not happen in a genuinely stabilizing additive such as F2TCNQ, because that one, when we measure it in a clean glove box, the device still performs well. So we need to decouple the effects of any additive that we use for performance enhancement from the effects of contaminants in the glove box. That's very important. And the other important conclusion from this slide is that we can use the bubbled nitrogen gas NMR test in order to deduce how far saturated the solvent filter of the glove box is. And we can also examine the effects of each individual contaminant separately. So, for example, let's look at the contaminants originating from plastic pipettes and plastic syringes. This contaminant, we identified it to be unsaturated alkyl amides, and more specifically, it's an amide called oleamide, which is a typical material used in these plastic pipettes and syringes. After we identified through NMR that the contaminant is really oleamide, we then took a polymer solution and that was originally clean, and we intentionally contaminated it. We contaminated it by washing 10 pipette tips and 20 pipette tips inside it, and then we made devices and saw the outcome. And as we can see on the right-hand side, progressively adding more and more oleamide into the solution, so contaminating it, tends to degrade the performance of organic transistors. It makes the turn on a lot less sharp, and it also reduces the mobility. And on the bottom row, you can see that this contaminant, oleamide, can also change the crystallinity in small molecule films. So progressively contaminating standard TIPS pentosine solutions with oleamide leads to more and more crystallized TIPS pentosine films. But this crystallinity is actually induced by the contaminant. Let's examine now the contamination induced by the disposable needles. The needles, we said that they have a rubber coating, a rubber PDMS coating, in order to avoid damaging the skin when injecting medicine into a patient. But what does this mean for organic electronics? How does the contamination from the needles affect organic electronics? As we can see, the literature in biology has already identified the leaching PDMS from disposable needles into solutions. The terminology in the field of biology is silicon oil-based subvisible particles. So when you each time that you use a disposable needle in a solution, it leaches these silicon oil-based subvisible particles. And what these particles have been demonstrated to do is cause proteins to aggregate and elicit immunogenic responses to patients. But what they can actually do in our case is that they can change the surface tension of polymer films as well as device performance. So just this PDMS contaminant originating from the needles can change our surface tension and device performance. How? Well, we can see that in the figures on the right. We can see that the methyl siloxane peak at 0.07 ppm that we saw earlier can originate from the PDMS coating of the disposable needles, as you can see on the image on subfigure A. And in subfigure C here on the top right, you can see the comparison between spin-coated IDTBT films and different amounts of needles washed inside the polymer solutions before the spin coating. This is high molecular IDTBT, and that's why it normally de-wets, as you can see on the sample on the left-hand side. It normally de-wets and doesn't form a uniform film because it's very difficult to dissolve. But if we just dip one needle inside the polymer solution, suddenly we end up with a uniform film, as you can see in the middle image. But if we overdo it, if we contaminate the solution too much, then as you can see on the right-hand side, the the insulator film that's on top of the polymer film starts to de-wet because we have made the surface tension of the polymer film too high because we mixed in too much of this PDMS. So what does this mean for device performance? We can see that on the bottom. The pristine device has a relatively good performance, and as we if we add a little bit of this PDMS contaminant, the performance becomes a little bit better, but if we add too much, the performance becomes worse. So that contaminant doesn't seem to have such a large effect on device performance, but it has a larger effect on the surface tension of the polymer film. And we wanted to delve a bit deeper into the changes in the surface tension of the polymer film due to PDMS, and we first tried measuring the contact angles between pristine samples and samples that had been intentionally contaminated with PDMS, and we actually found that there was no difference. There was no difference. So then we said, okay, there has to be a much more sensitive way to map the mechanical properties of polymer films that we have intentionally contaminated. And so we used a technique called peak force QNM, peak force quantitative nanomechanics, which essentially is an AFM technique that can spatially resolve the Young's modulus of elasticity for a given material. And we did that for IDTBT films, polymer films that we had intentionally contaminated with PDMS, and compared that to uncontaminated clean films. On the left-hand side, the four images show you on the top row the topography, and on the bottom row the Young's modulus of elasticity of clean films, and on the right-hand side you can see the same things for contaminated films with PDMS, of course. You can see on the left-hand side that in the clean films both the topography and the Young's modulus are very smooth, but as you can see on the right-hand side, with this technique we can clearly see the PDMS contaminant. The PDMS, as you can see from the topography in the top right, tends to form small clusters or blobs, and these clusters are the silicone oil-based subvisible particles that I mentioned in the previous slide. These are the particles. Now, it's interesting how the Young's modulus of elasticity changes with contamination. It not only changes in these areas, in these areas where the particles sit, of course it does change there, but as you can see from the bottom right-hand side image, the IDTBT polymer and the PDMS contaminant tend to form a mixed phase. They have some sort of miscibility. And so even in areas where the blobs, the particles, do not exist, the Young's modulus of elasticity changes because of the contamination. It becomes lower. So this is an important thing to look out for when making films, that the contamination can change the mechanical properties of the film. And for my final slide, I will mention how we used all these optimization protocols in order to choose the specification for our glove boxes in the cluster tool. Specifically, I'm going to mention the organic module, which is the module that we use to fabricate organic materials. We chose stringent working protocols in order to eliminate all these contaminants that I mentioned before in my previous slides, so to eliminate all the contamination pathways, and we have implemented these working protocols into the standard operating protocol of the Glovebox. We chose a regenerable solvent trap in order to continuously remove solvent vapor from the Glovebox and filter it out, and the regenerable solvent trap is being regenerated twice a week. We also chose a very strong purging module, which is able to purge the glove box atmosphere at a very high rate in order to immediately remove any solvent vapor prior to the experiment. We also do not allow extensive solvent storage in the glove box to reduce the solvent vapors as much as possible. And we continuously monitor the atmosphere inside the glove box with these NMR processes that I described previously in order to maintain a clean atmosphere. And with that, I would like to conclude and thank you all for attending this talk. And I really hope this has been useful for you, and that it shows you some insight on how to make clean organic electronic devices. Thank you very much.